From WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Tyke. Today on the program, the debate over developing herbicide-resilient seeds. Then, 15 years in orbit, and NASA's Chandra telescope is still going strong.
We are studying stars. We're studying supernova explosions, stars that can no longer hold their act together and blow up. We're studying galaxies that bump into each other and collide. We're studying the hot gas that fills the space in between galaxies that are out there.
We look at Ukraine through the lens of history, and writer Graham Simsion creates a socially challenged hero and a dilemma.
It was meant to be dramatic with just the occasional light touch, and people were laughing out loud. And, you know, I had a bit of an ethical question then to ask. It was great that he was generating comedy, but we'll be laughing at someone's disability.
Lake Effect comes your way next after news from NPR and Milwaukee Public Radio. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Tyke. Thanks so much for tuning in today. Keeping fields in high production preoccupies farmers around the country. Currently, the U.S. Department of Agriculture is considering a proposal to allow the commercial sale of herbicide-resilient corn and soybean seeds that, up until now, have been planted only in field trials. Public comment on the plan is being accepted through tomorrow. The genetically engineered seeds developed by Dow AgroSciences are designed to resist and survive the weed killer 2,4-D. The Environmental Protection Agency is conducting its own review of 2,4-D that's become more popular among some farmers as weeds increasingly outlive the powers of 2,4-D's predecessor, Roundup. WUWM environmental reporter Susan Benn spoke with two farmers, one who says USDA approval cannot come soon enough, the other who wishes it would never come.
Teresa Jonk was one of six daughters raised on a seed potato farm in North Dakota's Red River Valley.
We had a poison shed, and we actually called it a poison shed. And there was a skull and crossbones painted on the door to the shed, and we were told to never, never, never go in there. I left home with my mother's admonition to never marry a farmer.
Not, she says, because of the herbicides her dad occasionally applied to tackle weeds, but because her mother didn't wish the rigors of farm life on any of her daughters. Years passed, and Teresa Junk went off to college. That's where she met her future husband, Dan Podol, and learned about organic growing practices.
I was taking in a biology course, and the biology instructor put up slides of his certified organic farm. And I was like, wow, I had just no idea that you could practice agriculture without using, without having a poison shed, right? And so I ran back from the class to find Dan and said, wow, I just came back from this amazing class and started to tell him about organic agriculture, and he very quietly said, well, we farm organically.
His parents started farming in 1953. In 1972, Dan's older brother, David, took on its organic transformation. Teresa, now Podol, picks up the story.
Fast forward to Dan and I got married. Our intent was to go back to the farm and farm with his brother, David. David had a small grains operation. They grew up, they were a second-generation turkey farm. When Dan and I came back, we decided that we would bring the turkey flock back to the farm, only we were going to develop a certified organic meat production system. And so that was the next 10 years of our life, besides starting a family. We were told at the outset that it couldn't be done. We did it anyway.
Couldn't be done, why?
The poultry scientist that we were in conversation with said you couldn't get away from using a coccidostat.
A drug used to combat
coccidiosis.
Podol explains it's a soil-borne disease.
It's a parasite, and as turkeys are grazing around, if there's been a lot of turkeys around, they could pick up eggs of this coccidiosis, and they would develop this disease. And so he said, you can't raise certified organic turkeys. You can't do it organically.
Podol and her husband studied the issues and devised a solution.
And we were successful. So we developed our own label. We began marketing on the East and West Coast, which was where the market for organic was. And so we were able to produce turkeys for about 10 years using this organic system. And then we lost our processor. So, you know, one link in the chain from farm to market and we were done.
So Podal says they reinvented themselves organically. They developed an organic seed line. Her brother-in-law took the lead.
He had been breeding varieties for our own use for years. He couldn't find what he wanted in the seed trade, so he just started crossing things and making selections, and so he really is our farmer breeder.
The Podals started making seeds for other companies in 1997 and eventually packaged their own seeds.
Our most recent release is Sweet Dakota Bliss beets. So we have a pepper in development right now. We hope to release soon. Been trialing a number of carrot varieties as well, trying to find one that we would like to offer.
Maintaining the integrity of their grains and seeds is daunting because, Podal says, their 480 acres are an organic island.
We're surrounded by genetically modified crops, so corn and soybeans.
Although they time plantings to prevent cross-pollination with GMO crops, Podal says they don't always succeed.
With our seed operation, we've had difficulty keeping out GMO contamination.
They grow some specialty corn.
We raise a Flint corn. It's a rainbow Flint. It doesn't have any yellow kernels in it. And then we raise a sweet corn. We try to stagger the pollination windows to make sure that they don't overlap. So we can do some isolation that way. But if there is any overlap due to weather, which can very well happen, we do get trace amounts of GMO contamination.
The Podals handpick crops and inspect each cob of corn for contamination.
So as we're picking it, we're inspecting every cob and picking out any of the kernels that are obviously GMO. And then we haul all of our cobs back to the drying shed, the old turkey barn, and lay it all out on screens and go through it all again.
Podal sees the prospect of a new, more resilient, genetically modified seed, along with the occasional drift of herbicides from neighboring farms, as an ominous threat to organic farms like theirs.
Our family has built this very resilient system of agriculture, but it's not 2,4-D ready. And these are volatile herbicides that are prone to drift. And so I find myself in a situation where I'm not sure that our farm is viable. Years of working to make it possible to be fully employed within the farm is now at risk.
Some 560 miles east in Fond du Lac County, Wisconsin, conventional farmer Jim Zimmerman says he gets along fine with his organic neighbor.
We have a neighbor that grows organic sweet corn, and I know that they don't want a pollen drift next to them in their sweet corn. And they want to know what they need to do to make sure that they can maintain the integrity of their crop. So they give us a call and let us know, and we respond by telling them what our rotation is, what our plans are for this year, what it might be for the next 2 or 3 years, so that they can have a good idea about how to manage it.
Zimmerman's grandfather started the family farm with 80 acres and a herd of dairy cows. His father gradually added acres, gave up milking, and today Zimmerman and his brother manage 2,700 acres of corn and soybeans. Zimmerman says over the years, he and his brother have gotten better at what they do, doubling their output, while at the same time using less fuel and water.
It's much more sustainable. We do nutrient management plans, and we go through the soil loss equations, and when we plug all these things in, we're so low, it hardly registers on their scale. And so we're actually probably building soil. I know we are. We're building soil versus losing any to, air or wind erosion. And when you keep the sediment, the soil in place, you're keeping all the nutrients in place. And that's being a much better steward of the land. And that's what needs to be done, I think, and being able to have a chance at meeting that future demand.
But weeds are still a problem that Zimmerman says needs to be effectively addressed so his crops can meet the demand.
You know, in the state here, we have resistant weeds. That's mare's tail and giant ragweed. I think in the major growing areas, in the United States, in the Midwest, and then to the South, they have to deal with this Palmer amaranth, which was, I think, one of the first species that was documented to be glyphosate resistant. But what all of this does, they were able to manage these hard-to-control weeds, and in doing so, we are able to control them much easier and, of course, be more productive. And when we're able to be more productive, we can compete globally better. And that way, ultimately, with a larger supply, we're able to produce more feed, food, and fuel and fiber, and you know, which would actually work to keep the cost of food down.
Zimmerman says tension between large producers and what he calls niche organic growers is a constant.
They've been resistant to all biotech, and of course, they've been trying to figure out a way to coexist and whatnot. I believe they are trying to maybe level the playing field a little bit, you know, in their favor, being competitive. The larger agenda is, again, trying to meet the current future demand. And these other production systems are wonderful because it's great to have choice. We know consumers, you know, have different desires. And it's good to be able to have those choices for those different consumers. But overall, you know, they're not as productive systems, and they are only they're only afforded to do this in times when it seems we have enough food.
Zimmerman says he and fellow growers are frustrated with a drawn-out conversation around Dow AgroScience's herbicide-resistant seeds that he says seems perpetually stuck in the controlled study phase.
What's happened with this product is that it's been in the system, I think, for almost 4 years now. And, you know, we've been promised through USDA, APHIS, and EPA, and FDA, which, you know, look at all of these. They have a chance to look at all these products. And that is our regulatory system. And that we've been promised a shorter time frame in making their decisions to deregulate. We would like to think that the decisions would be based entirely on the science behind it. And it would appear that this being in the system abnormally long, that maybe they're not looking just at science. And that's always a cause for concern because agriculture is largely about science, the science that we have today. And we know it's always evolving.
Organic and conventional growers may never find common ground, but there are actually some common themes. Jim Zimmerman looks at farmers as stewards of the land.
That's what a farmer is. He's a conservationist. He's a steward because he's stewarding all these valuable resources. You know, it doesn't matter if it's the input products, say, you know, the fertilizers and things like that, and the seed technologies that he's using. You know, he needs to steward all of them. He needs to manage all of them. And the land, being most precious, of course, needs to steward that and do that in a sustainable fashion.
Back in North Dakota, farmer Teresa Podol hopes her three children can make a sustainable life on their organic farm. Jim Zimmerman's son just graduated with a degree in agronomy and is returning to work their farm. Zimmerman says there's nobody better at walking the fields and scouting for where and what problems need tending. For Lake Effect, I'm Susan Bentz.
Teresa Podol's family farms organically in North Dakota. Jim Zimmerman raises soybeans and corn in Fond du Lac County. They spoke with our environmental reporter, Susan Bentz. The USDA is accepting comments on the deregulation of the genetically engineered seeds through tomorrow. Some historical context for the standoff between Russia and the West over Ukraine when Lake Effect returns on Milwaukee Public Radio. Lake Effect continues on WUWM. I'm Mitch Teich. The situation in Ukraine continues to dominate the foreign policy landscape and drive a wedge between Russia and the West. As many seek to gain some understanding of why Ukraine has become a flashpoint, Lake Effect commentator Art Sear says we should consider some important historical perspective.
Russia President Vladimir Putin has sent troops into Crimea and is pressing a referendum later this month to confirm separation of the region from Ukraine. The European Union, the EU, and the Obama administration are aggressively protesting the invasion and threatening sanctions. No idle gesture given the structural weakness of Russia's economy. Violence in Kiev, the capital city of Ukraine, has taken dozens of lives as desperate authorities struggled to suppress growing protest demonstrations. The EU mediated a truce announced on February 21st, which has brought temporary calm to the city and should facilitate early presidential elections. Ukraine President Viktor Yanukovych, now a fugitive given refuge in Russia, tried frantically to survive in office. On January 28th, he removed loyal but ineffective Prime Minister Mykola Azarov and the rest of the cabinet. Earlier dictatorial moves amid corruption allegations sparked the demonstrations. The violence within Ukraine reflects a wider tug-of-war for alliance and influence between the EU and Russia. So far, the latter, led by President Vladimir Putin, has held the upper hand. Protests began in November when Ukraine's government rejected an historic agreement to associate closely with the EU and opted instead for expanded ties with Moscow. While the violation of human rights should be denounced, effective policy requires putting current events in broad historical context. George Kennan, probably the most perceptive American analyst of Russia, wrote in 1954 that Soviet leaders, quote, are not like us, unquote. War to the death with Nazi Germany has had a profound, continuing impact on the nation, including the current generation. Totalitarianism fed traditional anxieties regarding territory and national security. Contemporary Islamic extremism adds to ethnic tensions. Putin has successfully contained various separatist movements in Russia, notably in Chechnya. Chechen President Ramzan Kadyrov was previously a powerful separatist leader, but has been persuaded to change and is now allied with Moscow. The tough-talking officials of the George W. Bush administration pressed eastern expansion of NATO, including membership by both Georgia and Ukraine. Not surprisingly, Russia became alarmed. During this period, Georgia launched a military attack on breakaway South Ossetia. In reaction, the Red Army in 2008 invaded. President Nicolas Sarkozy of France brokered the ceasefire. The Bush administration did nothing. Ethnic instability is endemic to the entire region. During World War II, Soviet dictator Joseph Stalin suddenly arbitrarily deported the sizable population of Meskhetian Turks from Georgia as part of a vast relocation of an estimated 1.5 million people to Central Asia and Siberia. An estimated 700,000 Georgians fought in the Red Army. Smaller but still substantial numbers joined Hitler's forces. The forces on both sides earned in blood deserved reputations as dedicated warriors. Ukraine likewise is historically entangled with Russia in complex ways. The beginning of the Russian Revolution in 1917 sparked an independence movement. After years of struggle, Ukraine eventually was absorbed into the new Soviet Union. The Soviet regime forced collectivization of farms, resulting in vast mass starvation. Moscow authorities still suppress the details of this crime. Ukraine was also the target of murderous Stalinist purges aimed at destroying any independent sentiments. Given this history, essential caution should define U.S. policy, including on human rights. The Obama administration in this regard represents an improvement from the Bush boasters.
Essayist Art Sear is Clausen Professor of Political Economy and World Business and Director of the Clausen Center for World Business at Carthage College in Kenosha. Time now for another installment in our series, The Islands of Milwaukee.
Welcome to the Islands of Milwaukee.
This is Maureen Towie from the Islands of Milwaukee. Sometimes our questions of the day are just 30-second exchanges, but lately we've been taking these questions into the homes of seniors around Milwaukee. And then the questions can start a conversation that unfolds all afternoon. One of the people we've been having an ongoing conversation with is Bill. He's lived in Milwaukee for 40 years, but grew up on a farm in rural Michigan. When we asked him about the sounds of his neighborhood, he brought us back to his very first neighborhood and what it sounded like when everyone left the farm at the end of the season.
The most noticeable sound was no sound. And when I say that, generally I was one of the last off the farm in September. And Steve and I would be standing there at the end of the driveway. When the last car was heading out the driveway, we just stood there. And, you know, kids are crying in the car, and Lassie would even start racing down the driveway after us, and then she realized it's all over, and we got to wait till next spring. The cars would head up the hill to this second tier of roads and out towards the bigger road, and then they disappeared over the bluff. At least we saw some dust. Then we just stand there and wait. And we both kind of look at each other and get a little teary-eyed, because now there was no sound at all.
We are continually surprised by the stories that emerge from these simple invitations. If you or someone you know would like to answer our questions of the day, please call our islands line or visit our website. We love to hear from you. Each answer we receive helps us to create a more connected community. Thanks for listening.
You can participate in the Islands of Milwaukee project by calling the Islands Hotline at 414-678-1653 or by visiting islandsofmilwaukee.org. How looking at X-ray emissions from light years away helps us understand the nature of the universe when Lake Effect returns on WUWM. Of Lake Effect Now, I'm Mitch Teich. The popular science world is buzzing with the news that the classic PBS series Cosmos will soon return in updated fashion. While humans haven't walked on the moon in 40 years, we are still captivated by what's out there in space. And a payload delivered by the space shuttle back in 1999 still offers some of the most important insight. The Chandra X-ray Observatory allows scientists to observe X-rays from high-energy parts of the universe. On the ground, it's based in Boston, and the effort is directed by Dr. Harvey Tannenbaum. Tannenbaum spoke late last year in Milwaukee and explained to Bonnie North then why he pressed NASA to build the observatory in the first place.
Yeah, the actual idea goes actually into the early 1960s when the first X-ray sources were discovered, and Riccardo Giacconi, who led the team and actually received the Nobel Prize in Physics in 2002, a year after the first discoveries, talked about a telescope with properties quite similar to Chandra. But it was about 15 years later when he and I together wrote a proposal to NASA saying it's time to really get going on this project. And so in 1976 is when the work which led to what is now Chandra actually got started formally.
So for those of us who don't know what the differences in telescopes are, obviously it's looking at X-rays, but what does an X-ray telescope do and what do you see that you don't see with other telescopes?
Yeah, the astronomical objects, stars, galaxies, almost everything that's out there can put out its energy in various different forms, running all the way from the radio through the infrared, optical, things we see with our eyes. Infrared relates to heat, for example. Then X-rays, things that are very hot, and gamma rays, where even more energetic events are going on. And we call that span from the radio to the gamma rays the electromagnetic spectrum. And we've realized over the past few decades, if you want to really understand what's going on in a star or a galaxy, you really need to cover it with all the different kinds of telescopes. It's not enough just to look with your eye. In fact, your eye can't see most of what's coming in, both because of the wavelengths that the eye is tuned to, but also the atmosphere on the Earth. We have to get up into space to do infrared, to do X-rays, to do gamma rays. We can do optical and radio from the ground, but all the other parts of the spectrum, we have to get up into space. And so in the X-ray part of the band where Chandra's tuned is really looking at very hot and energetic events. So we often talk about stellar explosions and collisions, places where what we call cosmic violence is the catchword, and things that are very energetic. They're very hot. They may have very strong forces of gravity, very strong magnetic fields, and those are the kinds of conditions that can produce X-rays in reasonably large amounts. In order to detect the X-rays, we need a very different kind of telescope. And so this is not like going to the doctor's office where there's a machine that produces X-rays, shoots the X-rays through your arm, and then the bones sort of absorb some of the X-rays, and used to be film, and now, of course, it's CCD detectors, right?
Yeah.
See the shadows that the bones create. That's not what we're doing. It's just very similar to what people are used to thinking of when they think of a telescope. So there's a set of mirrors, and they're collecting light, but light in the form of X-rays that are coming from stars and galaxies that are out there in space. So the telescope focuses, it makes a picture, an image, and that comes onto an electronic detector. We have CCD detectors and what are called microchannel plate detectors, but they're ways of converting the X-rays into digital signals that we can then send back down to the ground and figure out what the image looks like by putting it all back together on the ground.
And then, of course, figuring out what it's telling us about the universe.
Sure. So, yeah. I mean, we look at the picture itself. Does it look like a pinpoint? Does it look like it has fuzz around it? How extended might it be? We can measure the energy of the X-rays so we can tell if it's very hot or just on the edge of being hot enough to make X-rays. We can look for signatures in the X-ray spectrum, which is the energy distribution, to tell us how much of the various different heavier elements are present, how much oxygen, how much hydrogen, how much iron, for example. It turns out that stars are factories where a lot of iron gets produced, and we want to know how much iron is produced by different kinds of stellar factories, and then eventually how it gets to form into new stars and planets like our own solar system and Earth.
So what is Chandra focusing on? What are the specific missions that are going on right now?
What's beautiful about Chandra is that it's an observatory, which means it can do all sorts of science. It does things that it was originally designed to do, and it's doing all sorts of things that have been discovered since the 70s and 80s and 90s when we were designing it and building it, and even since 2000 when the first science was being done. It's open to scientists all over the world, and people propose once a year, and they send in their best ideas. We get 600 or 700 proposals. We can pick about 175 or 80 of them just based on the limited amount of time that's available. So we are studying stars. We're studying supernova explosions, stars that can no longer hold their act together and blow up. We're studying galaxies that bump into each other and collide. We're studying the hot gas that fills the space in between galaxies that are out there. We're studying black holes in the centers of galaxies where material falls towards the black hole, gets pulled so hard by the gravitational forces of the black hole that it gets accelerated to very high speeds and a lot of energy is released, and most of that energy comes out in the form of X-rays. And then there are things like dark matter and dark energy.
So it sounds like Chandra has a huge amount to do and a huge amount to offer scientists here. How is it holding up? It's been in space for a little while, and it's been working for quite some time.
Right. So it's actually, of course, more than a little while. Chandra was launched in summer of 1999. So we've passed the 14-year milestone. It's interesting. Those of us who were in on the ground floor and helped design it and build it, if you ask us how long is expected to last, depending on who you ask or the day of the week you ask, you'll get a range of answers. I would have always said that it was designed to have a 5-year life in space. And anything that you could run out of, like fuel or power, those systems were designed to have at least double so that they would last at least 10 years. When we went back and actually looked at the details when we were having this discussion, we realized that when we were designing and building in the 80s and 90s, most of the electronic components that were being used in the spacecraft in those days had only been what's called qualified. They've been tested under very hard conditions on the ground, and they were certified that they were going to work at least 3 years. So to keep the costs manageable, we designed it with those kinds of parts which already were available and existed. So technically, the design life was 3 years for all of the components. We fully expected them to work longer than the 3 years. We hoped that everything would work for 5 years, and of course, now we're at three times that. And being so excited about the results and maybe being optimists, we actually do a study every 5 years or so. The team from what was TRW that had built the spacecraft and is now part of Northrop Grumman, They do a study to see what's wearing out, what problems we might be facing. And there are a few challenges, but by and large, things are working close to the way they were designed and how they worked when we first launched. So the most recent study is there's what we call no showstoppers, which means there's nothing which is imminently in danger of failing that would preclude us from going 20 years. And they're actually currently doing a look at 25 to 30 years for us.
Which is quite a substantial amount more than you ever expected.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And because of a bunch of conditions, many of which we don't completely control, the next X-ray telescope, which we can imagine eventually succeeding Chandra, is certainly not going to launch before the end of the 2020s. And even then, it will take a lot of good fortune and hard work to get there. So the fact that Chandra is the only X-ray telescope that has this kind of what we call angular resolution, the ability to take pictures as sharp as the pictures we take, the fact that it's still 15 years after launch, the request to use it outpace the available time by a factor between 5 and 6 to 1 every single year when we get the proposals in. We're not running out of ideas. We're not running out of discoveries. And it's totally reasonable to expect if it continues to work at something close to the current levels that we would actually use it for something like 30 years.
Well, let's hope.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, we do. We do hope, and we also work very hard. We have a great team that keeps a really close eye on things. If they see anything that needs extra attention, we're very, very careful. It's like handling our baby, and we take very good care of it.
You say that the next possible X-ray telescope might not happen until the 2030s. If you were designing it today, what would you change?
So there will be X-ray telescopes between now and 2030 besides Chandra. Some will be smaller. Some will be very specialized to do one particular area of science. But on the drawing boards and being worked today in the sense of something that could fly in the next few years, there's nothing that has comparable angular resolution. So the ability to take these pictures and have the sensitivity and the ability to distinguish very fine features that Chandra has. So what we will do differently, partly keeping in mind that still higher angular resolution, still even better pictures would be very challenging and very expensive. What we've been focusing on is to build something which will take pictures comparable to those that Chandra can take, but with 30 to 100 times the collecting area, bigger, and ability to see fainter objects, more distant objects, to collect more X-rays and be able to analyze the energy content in much, much greater detail. And we basically are working on ideas of how to make a telescope that weighs no more than Chandra, costs no more, and somehow will deliver between 30 and 100 times more X-rays down to the detectors. So, of course, to do that, we have to make the pieces, which Chandra's made out of glass that's an inch thick, the different parts of the mirror. We're talking about making things that are 0.4 millimeter thick, so about 50 times thinner. So if you imagine that if you make it 50 times thinner, you could get, for the same mass, about 50 times the collecting area. And we're working in the lab, and we're making very good progress at demonstrating the technology to do this kind of work.
Without the shuttles, though, would it be launched on a rocket?
Yeah, it will be launched on a rocket. It could fit on what is already available, either an Atlas V rocket that exists and is launching things. I don't know that it'll be launching things in, say, 2030, but there's a chance. And there's also a bunch of entrants into the commercial development. And there's a Falcon 9 Heavy that has all the capability to launch. In fact, it will cost substantially less to launch Chandra on an unmanned rocket than it did cost on the shuttle. One of the things that's really interesting about Chandra is that it's in this high Earth orbit, which means that every couple of days it goes to a distance that's the equivalent of a third of the way out to the moon. Of course, not always in the direction of the moon, but that's how far out from the Earth it gets, and it comes back down. And it's above the radiation belts of the Earth about 80% of the time, which means we can look at the sky a good fraction of the time. When we're in the radiation belts, there's too much noise in background, and our detectors basically can't see anything. But the other thing is because it's not going around the Earth in low orbit, a satellite that goes around the Earth, like the space station, like the shuttle, and even like Hubble, it goes from light to dark 15 times a day. It goes from being in sunlight, and it's getting power from the sun, and the sun's heating it up, and then it goes into the backside of the Earth, and the sun is blocked, and it has to run off its batteries. Its temperatures cycle up and down. Everything is mechanically and thermally being stressed 15 times a day. So there's a lot more wear and tear. Chandra doesn't have that. It goes out in this high orbit. When it comes down close to the Earth, occasionally the sun gets shattered for 10 or 15 minutes, but very infrequently, and it doesn't have the same stress. So once you build it and put it in this high orbit, you can't service it. It never gets close enough to the Earth to go up and fix anything. So even if we had the shuttle, and even if we had spare parts, there's no way to really rendezvous and put them in. But because it's in this orbit where there's much less stress on it, once you get there, it really turns out that there's a much better chance that it'll work a much longer time than you'd originally thought.
As it's been proven.
As it's been proven.
Right.
So it's a very cost-effective way. It has a little bit more risk associated at the front end, and everything has to work just as you've designed it. But once you get out there, and once everything's working, this possibility of a 10, 15, 20, and maybe even 30-year life is not just a dream. It's actually potentially a reality.
And, of course, it's just bringing back all of that wonderful information that helps us understand our universe.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Well, Dr. Tannenbaum, I can't thank you enough for coming in and talking this morning. I appreciate your time.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure. It's always fun for me to have a chance to talk about Chandra.
Dr. Harvey Tannenbaum is director of NASA's Chandra X-ray Observatory at the Harvard Smithsonian Center for Astrophysics in Boston. He spoke with Bonnie North in an interview which first aired in January. The hero of Graham Simsion's novel would likely approve of stargazing as a scientific exercise, but a romantic one, not so much. We'll learn about the Rosie Project after a break on Lake Effect from WUWM. Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio now. I'm Mitch Teich. Of all the leads in romantic comedies, the hero of Australian author Graham Simsion's novel is probably among the least likely. Don Tillman is a geneticist, a single one, and he's perfectly fine with that. But circumstances conspire to put him on the road towards finding a potential mate, which he tries to achieve through a thoroughly scientific questionnaire in which he tries to anticipate and eliminate anyone with whom he wouldn't be compatible. What the socially challenged Tillman does not anticipate is a woman named Rosie, who turns up at about the same time. An NPR review termed the results as an utterly winning screwball comedy, and Graham Simsion joined us by phone on a recent trip to the States. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me, Mitch.
If I understand correctly, this book was not originally supposed to be a novel, and it was also not supposed to be a romantic comedy. What was your original vision, and how did it evolve to the book that you ended up writing?
Okay, I enrolled at the age of 50, and this is going back about 6 years, in a class in screenwriting. And I decided that I was going to write a screenplay, and it would be a drama about a socially challenged man searching for a partner and the aftermath of him finding that partner. He would be a physicist, and along the way, we would learn a whole lot about physics. So that changed a lot as I learned about screenwriting, and as my vision of the story changed. It moved from drama to comedy. Don became a geneticist rather than a physicist, and the love interest changed from a nerdy Hungarian physicist to a woman who was exactly the opposite of everything that Don was looking for. So it went through an enormous amount of change. And then after 5 years of working on the script, and I'd got to a stage I was pretty happy with, and I had a producer lined up and everything, but no funding, I came up with the idea of writing it as a novel. I guess the original impetus was that it's easier to get a novel published than it is to get a movie made. And I already had a plot, I had characters, I had dialogue, so I was a long way down the path. But look, the other side of it was that I'd always had this dream of writing a novel and frankly didn't think I was good enough. But with those elements in place, I thought maybe this is the time to try it. And in changing to writing it as a novel, the story and I guess its tone changed a great deal, because in a film we're looking at our characters from the outside. The camera's looking at them and we only see the outside. But in a novel, you can explore a character's inner world. And as soon as I wrote that first word of the Rosie Project novel, which was I, everything changed.
Well, and I wonder if you had created this world, even though it was initially conceived of as a screenplay, did you feel that you owed it to the characters that you had dreamed up and the place that you had dreamed up to bring this into existence?
Oh, yeah, look, I did. I guess that's a bit of a highfalutin way of putting it. I wanted to tell my story. I wanted people to read it. I didn't think I owed anything to a fictional character. But look, I didn't go into this in a very highfalutin, high-minded sort of way. I wanted to tell a story, and I understood that themes would emerge, that ideas would be in there, that, you know, virtually unconsciously, because they're things I believe in and so on. But I'm not one who thinks it's a good idea to have a message and to be hammering that message all the time. I think the message comes through in telling a story and what you believe being layered onto that story.
The original Don, as you dreamed him up, was a dramatic character, but I'm curious whether the idea of a socially challenged person is naturally a more comedic concept or a more comedic conceit than you had originally realized.
Yeah, well, absolutely. I mean, what happened was I took a short story. In fact, when I say it came out of a screenplay, the very first incarnation of Don Tillman was a short story that I wrote to just sort of work up the character. I took that along to class, and it was meant to be dramatic with just the occasional light touch, and people were laughing out loud. And, you know, I had a bit of an ethical question then to ask. It was great that he was generating comedy, but, you know, were we laughing at someone's disability? And, you know, for all sorts of reasons, I concluded that this was a legitimate way to go. And certainly the feedback I've had, particularly from the Asperger's community, has been just almost uniformly positive.
Well, and you are you don't necessarily spell him out in this book as having Asperger's. And, you know, there's at one point he actually speaks to a group of people who essentially a support group for people with Asperger's or caregivers for people with Asperger's. But he talks about being wired differently. And I know you haven't necessarily wanted to diagnose a fictional character, but I'm curious whether there is something positive just in the idea that people are reading this and considering Don's status and maybe thinking about how other people they know relate to the world.
Look, absolutely. People often ask, how much study did you do on Asperger's syndrome? And I say, I spent 30 years working in information technology. You know, what study do I need to do? But the truth is, I really did not do any formal study of Asperger's syndrome, any reading on it, until after the Don character was absolutely formed. And even then, I really only read it so we could have discussions like this and I could talk in an informed way with that community. I never diagnosed Don as having Asperger's syndrome, but I sat down with an expert in Asperger's syndrome for lunch a couple of months ago, and he said, Graham, you can quote me on this, Don Tillman has Asperger's syndrome. So it's official, if you like.
Well, and if he, as someone who has Asperger's, is an unlikely hero in a romantic comedy, I think one of the other underrated aspects to him is that he is fairly far along in life. This would be a different sort of romantic comedy if he were closer to Rosie's age, but this is a hero who is essentially middle-aged.
Yeah, look, he's 39. And that was just a tough point as to where to draw him. I didn't want to could have made him older, but I wanted him to be old enough that he'd almost given up, that, you know, he had a lot of experience, it hadn't worked for him. Rosie's 29, so she's not crazily younger or anything like that, and she's clearly had some issues in her life as well, and she's got some father issues, so perhaps, you know, subconsciously Don is playing a little bit into that position, being that bit of an older man. But, you know, people say he's an unlikely romantic hero, and I think, well, hold on. I mean, the world is full of unlikely romantic heroes, if you like. The guys who get married, the guys who get relationships. Yeah, the women as well, you know, both sides. We're a whole mix of people, and many, many of us actually manage to find somebody. And I don't even think it's overly optimistic either. I mean, people will say, oh, you know, it's all a bit sweet because it, you know, I'm not giving too much away, it has a happy ending. Well, you know, a lot of people find partners.
Do you worry at all about the you know, I don't know if the reading demographics in Australia are similar to what they are in the States, but we hear frequently that men do not often read fiction and definitely not romantic comedy fiction. Did you see a challenge in writing as a man with a male protagonist for an audience that could just as easily be a female majority?
I was saved by my naivety. I had no idea that the audience for fiction was predominantly women until after I read my book. I'd started off writing movies, and you think, okay, people go to movies, date night, all that sort of thing. So I've written this book, and I go to the publisher, and I'm talking about the audience, and they're saying, hey, forget it, Graham. Men don't read romantic comedies. This is a women's book. What? But as it turned out, a lot of men have ended up reading it. I think the situation is exactly the same in Australia as it is in the US. But in Australia, certainly when I've been touring and that sort of thing, I've really pushed the idea that, you know, because it'll be an all-women audience, is take this, show it to your husband. Don't tell him it's a romantic comedy. Tell him it's a comedy about a man looking for a woman. Men will get that. Tell him to read the first 5 pages, and if they don't like it, throw it away. But just get him to have a go at it.
How much of your own early dating life did you mine for the material in this?
Look, I probably mined a fair bit of my own social awkwardness when I was younger, and I guess I'm not Robinson Crusoe there. I think most men, if they admitted, have had some pretty awkward dates when they were younger. There are no specific instances in there. I mean, like actual scenes that I can say, I lived that, you know, I lived the apricot ice cream disaster.
The jacket incident did not happen to you.
It did not happen to me. The jacket incident is based on something that happened to a friend of mine, and it, you know, he basically did turn up with a hiking jacket, going out to infect a restaurant in New York City, top steakhouse that had a jacket requirement, and he came along. I was with him. We never actually got to the restaurant because I checked out his jacket as we left, and I said, hey, you know, you can't go in that jacket. But you know, in the book, you say, what if, what if, what if? And you know, what if he's meeting his date at the restaurant? It's a first date, et cetera, et cetera. But broadly, I just mind my own awkwardness for some of it.
We have not talked much about Rosie herself, who it becomes evident fairly quickly will at least be his romantic foil. She has her own quest. What is she looking for? If he is kind of in his own strange way looking for the right person, tell us a little bit about Rosie's quest.
Rosie wants to know who her biological father is. So the story is that Rosie's mother had a one-night stand on the night of her medical graduation. And along came Rosie as a result of this, but Rosie's mother has passed away without ever telling Rosie who the real father is. Rosie knows it's one of the men in her mother's graduation class, and she wants to know who it is.
And conveniently, we have a hero in a geneticist who has some insight into how he might be able to figure that out.
Exactly, and I hope not too conveniently. I hope the causality is as clear as I can make it. I try not to rely too much on coincidences in these things, and it just sets up. Don's a geneticist. Yeah, he's the man.
Well, even if he had been a physicist, he might have been able to devise some way of figuring it out.
Oh, yeah. But I changed him. He was originally a physicist, and I changed him to geneticist as the story developed, and I wanted this quest of Rosie's to be in there. And it gives us a chance to do a little bit of instruction in genetics and evolutionary psychology, and you know, add a little bit of, I think, intellectual flavor to the book, or intellectual interest to the book. But yeah, so Don and Rosie head off on this quest to find out who her biological father is by surreptitious DNA testing. And that's the engine that keeps the story going, a sort of a whodunit that throws them together, even though they might not choose to be together.
Well, and so in the end, without giving too much away, is it oversimplifying things to say that this is for both of them the tug of war between what they think they want and what they really need?
Look, I don't think that's oversimplifying things at all. That's the heart of it, is do we really know what it is that we want? You know, we claim to know, or do we know what we need? We say, I want this. Don's got his 16-page double-sided questionnaire of the ideal woman, which Rosie doesn't meet at all. Rosie, in turn, is looking for an idealized father. She was brought up by her mother's husband, who has done, as far as we can tell, a pretty reasonable job. But she doesn't think so. She thinks that out there is the perfect father. And as they meet these candidate fathers, as it were, they start to find that some of them are jerks, you know, some of them aren't so nice. Nobody's perfect.
For someone who didn't originally want to set out to write a romantic comedy in the first place, how comfortable are you in that world now? Do you think that is this your oeuvre, to use a highfalutin term?
Well, it's interesting because once I realized that the structure I was working with in the film genre, because, I mean, romantic comedy is really a film genre, a movie genre, much more than it is a book, you know, literature genre. Once I realized I was in that place, I had to learn about the genre just so I knew whether I was following it or breaking it. So I did a lot of work. I watched a lot of romantic comedies. I watched a lot of screwball comedies, the precursors of romantic comedies from the 1930s and 40s and so on. And they informed the Rosie Project probably just as much as more modern romantic comedies like Sleepless in Seattle and Hitch and so on. So having acquired, you know, all this knowledge and signing a 3-book contract, I thought, I want to write another romantic comedy. And in fact, and that meant I wasn't going to be writing a sequel to The Rosie Project, because, you know, you can't write a romantic comedy as a sequel to a romantic comedy. Well, Helen Fielding can with Bridget Jones, Edge of Reason, but you've got to do something like break them up and bring them back together, which is, you know, or kill one of them and, you know, set them off again. And I didn't want to do that.
Well, and for people who have read the book, it maybe then is no coincidence that I am talking to you and you are in New York?
I am in New York right now, writing the sequel to The Rosie Project. I'm at 50,000 words at the moment. I stood up from the computer to talk to you.
Well, I am grateful that that you were willing to take that break, and we will be waiting for the sequel. Thank you so much, Graham Simsion.
Thank you. In the meantime, I hope that your listeners will read the original Rosie Project.
Graham Simsion is the author of the novel The Rosie Project, published by Simon & Schuster. We spoke with him by phone from New York. That's Monday's edition of Lake Effect. Tomorrow, it's our live Project Milwaukee broadcast from the Black Historical Society building. There are details on how to attend at wuwm.com/Project Milwaukee. I'm Mitch Tyke. Great to have you along today, and I sure hope you can at least tune in tomorrow and every weekday morning at 10 for Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee. Stay tuned. Fresh air is next. It's 11 o'clock.